Hello and welcome to COVIDcast, a Willow Institute podcast for anyone interested in the effect of coronavirus on the world and international life. My name is Roland Raja and I'm the lead economist and director for international economics at the Lowy Institute in Sydney, Australia. As this crisis unfolds, we are sitting down with experts from a range of fields to discuss the implications of coronavirus for the world. You'll find all the previous episodes on the homepage of our website. In this episode, I'll be speaking with Dr. Adam Posen on the US economy at a crossroads and what economic policy under a potential Biden presidency might look like. Adam Posen is the president of the Peterson Institute for International Economics, an independent and nonpartisan think tank based in Washington, D.C., which I should say produces a treasure trove of really useful and interesting economic research. So listeners should certainly check that out if you haven't already. Adam himself is a leading expert on the U.S. economy, macroeconomic policy, and the global economy more generally. He has been president of the Peterson Institute since 2013, and among many notable appointments was an external voting member of the Bank of England's Monetary Policy Committee from 2009 to 2012. Adam, welcome to COVIDcast.
Thank you so much, Roland.
So today I wanted to talk to you about the US economy at a crossroads, in particular amid the COVID-19 pandemic, of course, and the elections coming up in November. Just to start off with, where is the US economy right now? What is your assessment of current economic conditions and what's needed in terms of additional fiscal stimulus?
I think the US economy right now is on the turning point of what I've called the reverse checkmark recovery. That it's sort of like the Nike swoosh some people use, except the Nike swoosh implies you move backwards in time, which doesn't make any sense. So you go down really fast, you come up at maybe half the rate, which is still really fast, and then you start to plateau out because there's a limit to how much you can reemploy everybody quickly from the sectors that are getting permanently shifted, like hospitality. And that's the broad pattern in every developed country. The US, of course, has had more of an issue because our government has so mismanaged the public health aspects of the crisis and created so much uncertainty and, frankly, unnecessary death. You know, saying that is horrifying to say, but that's the reality. And the economic impact of that has been that we are seeing some setbacks in the growth and in the expansion of employment over the last several weeks, and that we may be seeing something of an earlier plateau at a lower level of recovery than, say, Australia or some countries in Western Europe or in East Asia have had. In terms of fiscal stimulus, to be fair, the U.S. government, meaning both the Trump administration and the two houses of Congress, did pass a lot of very well-designed, large, effective responses starting in March. And as Fed Chair Jay Powell, as I, much less importantly, as many people have said, it would be good to have one more burst of stimulus, especially while we're still getting the health aspect under control. And the best thing that they could do in terms of stimulus would be support for our state and local governments. I know that Australia is also a federal system. In the U.S., the state and local governments play a very large role in provision of services and income for lower income people. And they tend to have extremely pro-cyclical budgets because real estate taxes make up a huge part of, and local business taxes make up a huge part of their revenue stream, as well as them having balanced budget requirements. And so you see swings of a full percent of GDP in a recession from just the contraction automatically in the state and local government sector. And so that's essentially the lacking piece right now, along with some extension of the already existing special unemployment measures. That would be the right fiscal move right now.
And how likely, Adam, do you think it is that there will be enough fiscal stimulus coming through, given politics in the United States right now? You know, that then raises the other question, which is, what more could the Fed do as sort of the alternative if it has to? Obviously, interest rates are already basically at zero and it's buying all sorts of assets at this point. But if it has to do more, what could it do? And would that really have a meaningful impact at this point?
Well, Roland, I'm probably going to annoy you a little bit because I'm going to push back a bit on some of your words. You spoke in terms of if there has to be more, if the Fed has to do more. And this isn't like 2009 in the sense that, yes, there's huge human misery, but the economy is not on a death spiral because of economic panic or because of financial problems. The economy is on a downward spiral is because of the real factor of healthcare and public health. And so as a result, when we talk about is there more fiscal stimulus, it's about the human pain. And so I think it's a no-brainer at current interest rates to make sure that children don't go hungry and that people have unemployment, as former Fed Chair Janet Yellen wrote about just the other day. But it's not have to in the sense that if the fiscal policy doesn't come through soon, we will have a major recession or things will escalate. I mean, so we have to be honest about it. I think it was unimaginable to me a few weeks ago that they wouldn't do some kind of deal, that the Republicans in the Senate and the Democratic majority in the House wouldn't agree on doing a little too much by making sure that each one got something. So it's really quite stunning that we don't have an agreement. And I still expect there to be one in the next few weeks. But it is, after all the perfectly good, solid, quick fiscal action in the previous 6 months, and after the lessons learned in the U.S. and many other places from fiscal inaction in the last financial crisis, it's really shocking not to see it. In terms of the Fed, we're actually just around the time of the Fed's annual Jackson Hole conference, and the Fed is about to announce its new policy framework. But, you know, what's really going on is that the Fed is as showing the limits of monetary policy, that if you have a truly financial problem, a lockup in credit markets, a absence of liquidity, a panic sale, central banks can do a lot to stop that and put a floor under that and rectify that. But if you go beyond that sort of minimum response, you can't force businesses to invest, no matter how attractive you make borrowing. You can't force households to buy durable goods, buy cars, buy property, no matter how much you play with interest rates. And if that was true, if we were in Keynes's terms, pushing on a string back in the global financial crisis with monetary policy, we're even more so doing it now in the U.S. because ultimately what's got people scared and holding back is the health and economic implications of the pandemic, as well as the political, deep political problems in the U.S. So the Fed can do more, but essentially unless the problem becomes a financial problem again, I'm not sure how much more the Fed can do. It will not be terribly effective.
You know, we're talking a lot about the immediate near term, but when we start thinking more about the recovery path and the transition to post-COVID, how do you see the policy priorities? You're already speaking a little bit about monetary policy, but how are you seeing the macro policy strategy over slightly longer term, say 6 months, the next couple of years? And then in addition to that, I mean, what about taking care of those that have been hardest hit and are still going to be hardest hit, even in the medium term? I mean, what can be done to sort of reduce and limit the social scars that are coming from this crisis?
Those are the right questions to ask. And unfortunately, there's a very big gap between what I would like to see happen and what is realistic to happen in the U.S., even allowing for a Biden presidency. So in terms of the macro strategy, right now, as my colleague at Peterson, Olivier Blanchard, has argued, we have these really sustained low interest rates. And as Larry Summers has argued, we have secular stagnation, meaning very little competing demand for private investment, very little animal spirits. And so as a result, there's no crowding out if the government borrows. And we see that in the interest rate futures. So the fiscal question, though, is there are still limits to fiscal policy. You don't want to waste money just because it's cheap, because someday you will need some of it back. And you want to have the capacity, if God forbid there is another disaster like this, to put out 20% of GDP looking after people in a short term. So the big story over the next few years is figuring out how do you get that path back in fiscal policy without prematurely cutting things off, without prematurely cutting people off from help and cutting the economy off. And so the reason I bother to put down that marker is there are people in the U.S. debate and elsewhere, people who go by names like MMT, Modern Monetary Theory and such, who say that there is no limit. And what Blanchard and I think the mainstream profession has argued, and I would agree, is there is no short-term limit for fiscal when interest rates are this low, but that's unnatural and unfortunate when interest rates are this low, because it means that there's no underlying growth energy in the economy, basically. It means there's no productivity growth, there's no demand for investment. And so you have to be prepared for times when interest rates will be higher, because it is a sick economy that is the way it is. You have to hope for an economy in which there's higher interest rates someday. But in the short term, meaning 6 months or even 2 years, it's just going to be about continuing the programs that we're talking about now. And the biggest issue is, going back to what I was trying to say without visuals about the reverse checkmark, you've got this long process of having to really allocate people out of industries that are likely to persistently contract. You know, hospitality, in-person retail, some kinds of services, some kinds of tourism, certain elective medical procedures. You've also got a reallocation geographically, and I don't know if this is true in Australia and, say, Sydney the way it is in the U.S., but you have a lot of people changing their minds about what kind of housing do they want. Do they want to be in the inner city? Do they want to be in a single-family home or multifamily housing? If you're young, is it worth it, having gotten hit on the head for the second time in 10 or 15 years or knowing people who have, to buy housing? And so there's a lot of structural change that has to go on in economies. Now, it would be nice to think the markets will take care of this. And the markets are, of course, the key leading role. But policy, both for humanitarian reasons and for efficiency reasons, has to get involved. And that's, I think, the big challenge.
A lot to dig in there, Adam. But actually, I want to move us along to the upcoming presidential elections in the US. I want to get your views on Donald Trump. I mean, Biden is seemingly well ahead in according to the polls, but you know, second Trump presidency certainly can't be ruled out. So as someone who's been watching very closely and analyzing the Trump administration's policies over the past few years, I mean, what's your overall assessment of Trump's approach to economic policy? And more importantly, what does this tell you about the implications of what a second Trump term might be and what it might look like if he were to prevail in November?
Yeah. So I regret to say, I think the chances of him prevailing in November remain uncomfortably high. I'm not a terribly partisan person, but the Trump administration is doing evil in the world and should be ousted. And it's kind of amazing to me, given the COVID, that they're not clearly losing. But they're not. It's not for sure. And there are a bunch of white people, particularly white males of less education in the U.S., but not solely those, who are going to vote Republican on a racial basis, no matter what. So the prospect of a second Trump term is very real. As I discussed when I had the privilege to visit Lowy a couple of years ago, one of the distinctive things about the U.S. system, unfortunately, is that the Office of the President has been accumulating additional discretionary power for the last couple of decades, starting under Bush-Cheney, was extended under Obama, and was extended again under Trump. And particularly since the U.S. Senate, under the Republican majority, is unwilling or uninterested in standing up to Trump, his executive power is quite extreme right now. And so anything that doesn't involve specific taxes and large-scale spending doesn't require congressional approval. He can make huge changes to environmental regulations, labor law, police enforcement, trade, national security, all through executive order. And this is not going to change unless Biden gets both houses of Congress for the Democrats and chooses to make a constitutional change or a close quasi-constitutional change and give this up himself. Trump certainly won't give it up. So what you would see is additional moves in the direction he's been going, which is extreme deregulation in a lot of sensitive industries, extreme militarization domestically of immigration policy, of law enforcement, and just a lot of corruption. It's a very scary picture. And then on trade, the issue is, just as we just saw with this famous thing about, was Kodak going to be the rump of Kodak that remained going to be involved in vaccines? Is he not going to buy Goodyear tires, because even though they're the tire of choice of the Secret Service, because they banned MAGA hats at his plants? I mean, there's so many examples. You just see this incredible politicization of every decision about our people, our Goya beans being touted by the Trump people as opposed to, you know, other beans. It's mind-boggling. And so on trade, you'll just continue to see the bilateral bullying that we've seen and attacks on the World Trade Organization. And it's corrupting. It ruins productivity growth. The one thing that doesn't change much Biden to Trump is that the fear and anger and disappointment with the Chinese regime is a bipartisan shared value in Washington. You can see Biden and the Democrats are using Trump actually been too soft on China as an attack on Trump in the campaign, and Trump is doing the same back to Biden. And so I don't think that will change much in a Biden administration. The question is, how much does then the Biden administration behave more multilaterally, behave more decently to allies, including Australia, not pick other trade fights, let itself get involved in multilateral rules? And the answer is probably a lot compared to Trump, but not as much as some people hope.
Picking up on those topics there and turning to you know, how other countries react. When we did have you last at the Lowy Institute, you shared some very interesting thoughts, very provocative thoughts on, you know, how other countries should really react to the Trump administration. And at that point, it was quite early on in the process. And even then, if I recall correctly, you were advocating that other countries needed to, if not push back, needed to be very firm in responding to the directions the Trump administration was going internationally. Now, a few more years into Trump's presidency, if there was a second term, what would your advice be to other countries like Australia?
Yeah, it's a very daunting prospect. I have an article forthcoming in East Asia Forum, another fine Australian publication, talking about what countries like Japan and Australia should be doing in the economic sphere if there is another Trump administration, or if the Biden administration doesn't change behavior as much on the international front as we hope. And I've talked about pursuing what I call principled plurilateralism, which sounds not that exciting. But the basic idea is they're taking what Australia and Japan did with CPTPP and saying, we're not going to be defined by whether the U.S. is going to be a break on rules or not. We're not going to be defined by relations with China, that obviously Australia right now is having a lot of threats and conflicts with China, but that we're going to build plurilateral arrangements, and it doesn't have to be trade. It can be agreements on investment. It can be agreements on internet privacy. It can be agreements on vaccines, as New Zealand and Australia have been leading recently on medical supplies. You say, this is a principles-based agreement. This is not geographically specific. In principle, we have no problem with the U.S. or China wanting to join, but here's the rules and here's how we're going to do it. And essentially, you need a new kind of non-aligned movement in the international economics for the coming decade that's more constructive than the non-aligned movement that arose in the 70s. And I think there's a lot of room to do that. I think more generally, there's got to be a more of a willingness to just stand up to a Trump administration and not worry about offending them and push back. We saw that Mexico and Canada actually did okay by pushing back on his demands to some degree in USMCA, the NAFTA 0.8, as I put it. We've seen the EU start to draw lines, and that is where it's going to have to go. It's not going to be as good as a world when the U.S. behaves properly, but it's the best alternative we got.
So just picking up on that there, can I ask you then more about what a Biden policy approach might look like, particularly with regard to both China and trade policy? I mean, you mentioned that the question is how Biden will work more with other partners. I mean, how do you see that playing out? And I think an important question is also, how do you think China will react on the economic front, at least, to a Biden presidency?
Well, I think, Roland, the Chinese Communist Party leadership, obviously under Xi, has changed its outward attitudes in the last few years. That doesn't justify the Trump behavior. The Trump behavior isn't going to do anything to help it. But what it does say is that the traditional role of Democrats for 40 plus years now has been to put more emphasis on human rights and foreign policy. And so when we talk about Taiwan, Hong Kong, the Uyghurs' imprisonment and camps in northwest China, these are things that will be barriers to good relations between the U.S. and China, even if China were more quote-unquote reasonable on economic factors, if a Biden presidency takes place. And so how much a Biden presidency and his team would be willing to sort of make some Kissinger detente with the USSR? How much are they willing to sort of say there's a national security sphere where we're in conflict, there are certain technologies we don't want you to get, but beyond that, we want to find places we can work together? Now, Obama was very much, the Obama administration approach was very much of that mode, and people debate how effective it was. If you had fantasies about transforming China under the Communist Party into a beautiful, liberal, peaceful, wonderful place, well, of course it failed. But if you look at things China did on climate change, on intellectual property protection, on letting their students come to the West and learn and get exposure, the Obama approach, I think, did bear some fruit. But there is a whole wing of the Democratic Party that feels China has been taking advantage of the U.S., and it's very dangerous. I think this is vastly overstated, but it's a bipartisan view. There are a lot of senators and congresspeople who believe it. Another thing, you know, I can see a Biden administration not directly attacking the WTO, not directly trying to put bullying tariffs on the EU or Japan, but I can't see them immediately turning around and doing huge amounts of trade liberalization. I can't see them suddenly saying, you know, international integration is great. I can't see them deciding to say all this stuff that the Trump administration did about trying to move manufacturing home is nonsense, even though they should, they won't. And so then it becomes very interesting to look at CPTPP especially. Biden was there, and we don't know what his views were because, of course, he supported the president. But our understanding is Biden is open to the arguments, the standard national security foreign policy arguments for why TPP was a good idea. But it's two things going on. First, it's going to mean trying to make CPTPP even more of an anti-China alliance than it was initially thought of being, and which it has been less of course, without the U.S. And second, it means that some of the things that led to the passage of USMCA, the revised NAFTA, like much more rhetoric and attention to enforcement of labor and environmental standards, which in principle can be very good, that's going to be brought into TPP. The U.S. under a Biden administration isn't just going to say, okay, we missed our chance, now we accede to whatever it is you guys already agreed. They're going to come in and, you know, go after Burma and Vietnam and whoever else about labor laws. Again, maybe a good thing, but that's a reality.
Good. I was hoping you'd come to the question on the Trans-Pacific Partnership. I think a lot of people over here certainly hoping that a Biden administration would be coming back to that. We probably have time for just one more question before we wrap things up. So I want to bring you to climate policy under a potential Biden administration. I mean, what do you see this looking like? Obviously, the left wing of the Democratic Party has been pushing very hard on this front. You know, I see that Biden has said he would recommit to the Paris Agreement, but also would be looking to push other major countries harder and to increase their level of ambition in terms of climate change mitigation, including, he said, by using American economic leverage. So what are your thoughts on what that might look like? Could it look similar to the direction that the EU, for example, is heading with border carbon adjustments?
I think that's where things are going. Just to be clear, as opposed to trade or specifically China trade in particular, I think the change from a Biden administration, from a Trump administration, would be day and night in climate change. You would go from total denialism, oppression of the civil service, denial of facts, deregulation of domestic dirty carbon extraction. All of that would be reversed 180 degrees. And as I mentioned, a lot of that can be done through administrative orders, executive orders by the president. It doesn't even require legislation. Then, of course, you run the risk that the next president could reverse it back again. So at some point you want legislation, but, you know, day one, yes, Biden can recommit to the Paris Accords. Day one, Biden can change the standards and ease of doing fracking and tight oil extraction. Day one, Biden can make commitments on these aggressive targets that he stated. My problem is, I mean, and that's worlds better. My problem is twofold as a sort of practitioner type of economic policy. The first is, you know, the EU said all these great things and has talked about carbon pricing. The Paris Accord says all these great things. Biden now says all these great things. The amount of progress we've made is minimal. Minimal versus the scale of the problem, but also even minimal in its own terms. And I just need fundamental changes to heating and cooling systems, to energy consumption, that are just, you know, economists fantasize and politicians jointly fantasize with them. Oh, all we're going to do is change the price of carbon and then everything will fall into place. But that's not happening. And it's not credible that you're going to get that big a change in the price of carbon. At least I hope I'm wrong, but that doesn't seem to be where we're going. So a big issue is, fine, the EU is going to make these pledges. Biden is going to make these pledges. That's infinitely better than not making these pledges. But how do we make these pledges bite in a way that actually starts changing things? The second issue, as you rightly mentioned, is the question of extraterritoriality. In a sense, you know, if I'm the EU or if I'm the US and I'm suddenly cutting edge on climate change, which the EU is, relatively speaking, you know, how much am I able to induce or threaten others into behaving? And I think border adjustment taxes are going to be a wave of the future. Economists are split on these. There's some arguments that they're not going to matter that much because ultimately the global trade is going to get through. But I do think it will matter, and particularly for energy and natural resource exporters like Australia, I think there is a lot of room for these governments to be pretty bullying. But the bottom line is that's where we got to go. I mean, there has to be change. The issue is, how hypocritical is the US going to be about doing this?
Thank you for that, Adam. That's really interesting stuff and a lot to think about there, including for Australia. Let me thank you again, Adam, for joining me today to discuss COVID-19 and the US economy at the crossroads.
Roland, thank you for having me. I appreciate the opportunity.
COVIDcast is a limited edition podcast from the Lowy Institute. Thank you to my colleague, Jennifer Reinhart, for production assistance. Please keep an eye on our social media channels for details of the next episode of COVIDcast. And you can stay up to date with all the latest developments on coronavirus via the Lowy Institute's widely read digital magazine, The Interpreter. Thank you all for listening today, and we'll catch up with you again on the next episode.